While this show was not recorded for political purposes, I thought it'd be a great time to re-ear overcoming our obstacles and achieving your dreams. Because it's the story of a young American male who was separated from his parents due to abuse, who wound up in the foster care system, who moved 21 times in 5 years. He talks about the atrocities that occurred in that time from the age of 8 to the age of 15. And he goes on to tell us that he did not become a victim because of what happened to him. He did not choose to live in victimhood, but chose victory. James also shares with us what he believes to be a plan in place that uses foster kids in order to make big profits. So for now, sit back, relax, and enter into the Miracle Zone. At the end, heading into the next stage, it feels like you can't make it. It feels like all hell is breaking out against you. It feels that way because you're almost there. The birth canal is the narrowest. Just before delivery, it's the darkest and the coldest just before dawn. Hello, I'm Pamela Chapman. Welcome to Miracle Zone, making it reality against circumstance, logic, and economics. Appropriate for today when it often seems like a changing, chaotic, and very crazy world keeps us in difficult transition. Today is Tuesday, August 1st, and I'm coming to you live from my place of miracle, the beautiful Summer Rockies in Colorado. We have shifted once again. Thank you for allowing me to have some time out of your incredibly busy schedule to help guide you into your very own dream come true. I'll facilitate your journey into whatever you care to manifest for this time. So, whether you are transitioning through a job loss, career change, mate change, empty nest syndrome, retirement, or plain old limbo, I'm here to help make the transition as painless as possible. I'm really excited to have this young man on the show, special guest James Poindexter III. But before I bring him on, I want to do our grounding. Since we are that spiritual show, I want to make sure all of our listeners are at least grounded before we bring our guest on. So if you are seated, close your eyes, and you can even do this standing. Close your eyes with me. Take a deep breath. Breathe in through the nose, expanding your stomach, and out through the mouth. Once again, breathing in through the nose, and out through the mouth. Now, with your eyes closed, I would like for you to imagine that there is a root coming from your tailbone, a root that looks like a tree root. If you're standing, those roots can be coming from the bottom of your feet. The zero chakra is at the bottom of your feet. Your first chakra is at your tailbone. And we're going to see that root pushing down, down, south, south, breaking through the floor, breaking through the earth crust, I'm pushing the lava, magma, all the way down as far as you can see, reaching for the core of the earth. And I want you to imagine with me that those roots are wrapping itself around that core. Some of you may hear a latching on. Some of you will actually see that. Once you have accomplished that, you are grounded. And what do we mean by that? That things may come along today and you may sway, you may wobble, but you won't fall down. Today's topic, overcoming obstacles and achieving your dreams with James Poindexter. I'm going to get out of the way. I want to welcome James to our show. James, welcome.
Hello.
To Miracle Zone. Hello. How are you?
Hey. I'm great, man. How are you?
I'm doing great. Welcome, welcome, welcome. We're very happy to have you on today.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here for sure.
I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind, James, I'd like to have my guests introduce themselves. But first, before we go there, I want to just tell the audience that when I heard your story, I felt that you were a great match for the Miracle Zone because, as I always say, Miracle stands for making it reality against circumstance, logic, and economics. And certainly your story is all about that. So I always like to have people who have gone through something on my show versus writing books about it and, you know, and telling us what we should expect. You have been through it, and so you're a wonderful match for us today. So take some time, please, and share with the listeners what you would like the listeners to know about James Poindexter today, please.
Okay, so I am a guy who has been through a lot of interesting things. At 10, I entered the foster care system, and, you know, from 10 to 15, I moved 21 times. And that was between different shelters and homes. And then at 15, you know, I found some foster parents who put me in a good situation. You know, they grounded me, as you referring to what you do there. They grounded me. They made me feel, you know, that I wasn't going to get shipped off again somewhere else. And they gave me an outlet, which was martial arts. And that was supposed to be my anger management program. That's what that was. That was supposed to be part of a program to help me deal with all the anger that I have been through my entire life. And what ended up actually happening was that it turned into an extraordinary thing. I ended up winning tournament after tournament until I won state nationals, got on the USA team, and ultimately became the world champion of martial arts. And I was ranked number one in the world for 3 years in karate. And all of that was unexpected. It was just supposed to be something that gave me an outlet for my frustrations, and it turned into that. You know, then I went on to college, got 2 degrees. And then I started my business, JH Brands. And now I am speaking, a professional speaker, and I've written a book about my experiences. And it's turned out pretty well.
You have an amazing story. So in the foster care system at 10 years old and moved 21 times, that's amazing in itself. And, you know, James, I always tell people I don't believe in the words I can't. You know, I think Henry Ford is the one who said, believe you can, believe you can't, and you're absolutely right, whatever you believe about yourself. And so when people come along and say, oh, I've had such a terrible life, I can't make it, there's nothing I can do, I'm a victim. And then a young man like yourself comes along and says, well, I've had some pretty horrible things happen to me as well, and I've made it, I've succeeded. And I believe that is possible with all of us. I believe we all can do that. I know you said that you've had some pretty bad experiences, or, you know, you've been through a lot. Do you care at this time to share any of that in detail? And with that, how were you able to get through those experiences? Would you mind sharing that today?
Oh, yeah. That's no problem. Within the system, or just how it all started and everything? Like, where do you want me to go with it? I'll go anywhere.
Whatever you want to share with the audience, how you got there, because that story is pretty interesting. Why don't you start there, how you got into the system, take us through a few experiences, and then bring us out of that. How's that?
Okay. Yeah, so what happened was my parents were pretty abusive. And when I say abusive, you know, I'm not talking about, you know, bend over the knee spankings. You know, I'm more talking about, you know, my father, who was more of a, he was more of a rage person. He liked, when he reacted to things that made him mad, he was the kind of person who would just explode. He, I always called people like him an exploder. He just reacted. He would sit there and let things ball up inside, and then he would just explode. And what that usually led to was a lot of rough situations for me. And so, you know, he used to like to hit us a lot, and it wouldn't just be hitting. You know, if he was sitting around something, whatever that something that he had around him, he was throwing at us. You know, and I remember vividly, you know, he threw a hammer at me once. He threw a saw at me. They would whip us, but the whippings that they gave us were very different kinds of whippings. So they actually had different styles of whippings that they would give us. And one was just the regular over-the-knee type whipping. But then the other one was a buckle whipping. So they would take the belt and turn it around and hit us with the buckle. You know, and I'm 8 or 9 at this time. So this is when this is going on.
Right.
And the third one, which was the worst one, we would call the wet whipping, because that was the one where we take a bath, pull us out of the tub, and then they whip us. And so while we didn't dry off, they wouldn't let us dry off, so we would get out of the tub wet, and then they would whip us, you know, with the belt while we were soaking wet, which really hurt. And with your pores open, you get very sick from that as well. And so that happened, you know, sometimes as well. So these are the things that were happening to me during this whole situation with my biological parents. And then it all got discovered one day in recess when I was at school playing dodgeball, and I was very good at dodgeball. I used to always win. But this one day, I just couldn't grab the ball because my arms hurt from where I had got hit the night before. And this kid threw the ball at me, and I just let it hit me because I couldn't grab it. And the teacher, when the ball hit me, I collapsed. The teacher took me to the side and pulled up my shirt, saw all the bruises. So she called DHHR, and a guy came to my house. That guy's name was Ron Kellerman. I still remember his name from all those years ago. And he asked me who did it. And, of course, I didn't want to say who did it because I didn't want to get in trouble. So I wouldn't tell him anything. So then he told me, well, just nod your head up or down, and then that'll be enough. So then he said, did your parents do it? So I nodded my head yes. Then he left. Then when I went home, he was already at my house. And that day, my parents were the nicest to me that ever in my life that I can remember. Later, of course, I found out it was because he told them if they hit me again that he was going to take them. But as soon as he left, it all changed back. And they said to me, so you think you can tell on us, and that's what's going to get you out of your punishment. Well, we'll make sure we fix that. So they didn't hit me anymore, but they started starving me. And it was me and my sister, because I have an older sister as well. And they decided to not let us eat for 2 or 3 days at a time. and they make us stand in a corner facing a wall. We'd have to stand up facing a wall and just not eat all day, or not eat. If it was Friday, that was the worst because they wouldn't let us eat until Sunday evening. So we would have to miss a couple days of eating. And so that was how they started, you know, that's how they solved the situation of punishing us, because they, you know, they couldn't hit us. So they had to find a way to do it. That's what they did.
They couldn't leave marks anymore. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. They couldn't leave any marks anymore. So they just decided, well, if we starve them, that'll be, you know, that'll be a form of punishment right there. That'll do it.
Right.
And then somehow my mom and my dad argued, and mom left, took my sister and left. I don't really know what all that was about. I still, to this day, don't know what all that was about. And, you know, it was me and my dad. And when it was me and my dad alone, things were pretty good. He didn't hit me. We got along. It was pretty interesting that when they weren't there, we got along really well. But then Dad decided that he wanted Mom, so he decided to go get Mom. And he just decided to leave. And he left, and he left me in the house, and he took off. And I was 10. I didn't see him again until I was 25.
Wow.
And so he literally just left me in this house, and I was there for a week waiting for him to come back, and he never came back. And so I went around the corner to my grandparents' house, and they kept me for a little bit. Then they gave me to my other grandparents, where I found out where the abuse from him came from. It came from his parents, because they abused me as well. And that was pretty rough too, because, you know, just when you think you're out of the whole abuse thing because your parents are gone, then your grandparents are doing it as well. And
yeah, that had to be pretty painful. Like you said, going from leaving, getting out of that environment, believing you're safe, and then just walking into it all over again. So if I may bring you forward just a little bit, and thank you so much for sharing that. And the reason being, because there's so many people, again, who say, I'm a victim. So now, come forward just a little bit with me, and how did you find yourself being able to go forward? Or how do you survive in that type of environment? What happened to you from there? There's some good things happened in there, I'm hoping.
Well, when you're in these situations, you know, I try to look back sometimes on those situations, especially when I speak about it, and really, when you're in it, you're just thinking about surviving. So you're just in survival mode. There isn't a plan. You know, if I do this and this, then I'll be here and here. There isn't a plan. It's just, how do I make it to tomorrow? Where is my next meal? Where is my bed? Where is my stuff? And you just kind of roll with the punches every day, and time just goes by. And so when you're in survival mode, you don't really think about the future too much. You just think about the now. And, you know, I was getting shipped around between family members at first. It was grandma to aunt. But then they convinced me to emancipate myself. So I went to court, and because of them, and I said, you know, to the judge, I didn't want my parents to be my parents anymore, and I became a ward of the state. But I thought I had the understanding that if I did that, you know, that my family would take me. My aunt, I wanted to live with my aunt because my aunt and my cousin were awesome. But what actually happened was they put me in a shelter, and that's where it all started. And so I was abandoned by my family. And though I was hurt and I was thinking, you know, why would they do this? At the time, I didn't have time to think about it because I had to adjust to wherever I was at. And I was always the youngest and smallest everywhere I went. And so a lot of the time I tried to stick to the staff, but things still always happened to me. So I wouldn't say that a lot of great things really happened until I was 15. That's when all the good stuff really started happening. But in between there, going from home to home and shelter to shelter, you know, a lot of violence. I was also raped.
Going from the different homes, you were actually suffering more abuse going from foster home to foster home.
It was mostly in the shelters.
In the shelters.
Because I was,
okay.
I was going, yeah, I was going through the different homes and shelters. Foster care, by definition, is temporary. So unless you get adopted or someone becomes your legal guardian, you're only going to stay in that home for a certain amount of time. And the goal is to reunite you with your biological family. And so as a whole, it's temporary. So you know when you're in a shelter, you're probably not going to be there very long. And when you're in a home, unless they really like you, you're probably not going to be there very long either. So that's why there was a lot of moves. And, you know, my time limit came up. No one could find me a home. And the older I got, the worse that got, because people like babies. They don't like kids that get older and older. And so I had trouble finding a home until I was 15. So a lot of bad things kept happening to me in these shelters.
Yes. So now tell us about 15, because now that's a turning point in your life, right? Tell us
yes.
about that. Please.
It was the last, it was my last shelter that I was in. They're not in, what would I say now? They're not a business now. They were called the Wesley Youth Center. And the lady comes down, says to me, "We found you a home." Her name was Renee Ellenberger from the National Youth Advocate Program. And, you know, I looked at her and I said, whatever, because I had heard that so many other times before. But when I went, when she drove me to this house, during the drive, it was like a two-hour drive, and we were talking, and I decided in my head, you know what, I'm going to age out soon. I'm 15. I'm probably going to age out at 17 or 18. I might as well just try to figure out how to stay here, whatever I got to do, and just age out and be on my own. When I got to this house, they introduced me to Robin and Carolyn Griffith, and, you know, I just felt something. And my parents, they were very straight. They were very straight with me right from the start. They said, you know, this is your opportunity to stay. We're not going to send you back. If you go back, it's because you sent you back, not because we sent you back.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad put that right on me, like right from the start. And he's
right
a military dad.
It's on you.
Yep. Dad is a black and white kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
And because he's military-minded.
Yes.
And that's probably what connected with me the most was that, you know, you go through life with a lot of fluff because you go through so much hard stuff that the therapists and the social workers, they all want to fluff you to make you feel better. But he didn't do any of that. He was just straight. And that's
right.
What connected with me. So later on, I found out many years later that the idea of bringing me to that house was Dad's idea. It was not Mom's idea. Mom wanted a baby. In the initial conversation about bringing me there, Mom had said no. Dad has said yes. And this is very significant because it is my mom that I'm really, really close to. Like, we ended up becoming way more close than anyone else. Even
yeah.
though she was the one who initially didn't want me to be there.
Right.
And that connection happened because Dad had his own son, but he was not Mom's son. He knew who his mother was, so he never called Mom. He knew his mom, and so I kind of became her son. And we got very close. But what happened was, you know, they taught me some hard lessons. I was a knucklehead, man. I didn't listen to too much at first. And
I don't think any teenager does, James.
Well, you know, my dad made sure that he forced home his point often. And everything he did was calculated and had a lesson behind it. And that's something I admire greatly. And he would go overboard to make his point, but his point was always made. And that's what I valued. But they put me in martial arts as part of my anger management program, and because I needed an outlet. And this was Mom's idea. Dad had said no to that. he didn't want someone who already was very violent learning how to be better at being violent.
Right.
And so he initially said no. But, you know, when the argument is between husband and wife, wife is probably going to win. And so she did.
Uh-huh.
And wife and social worker combined, and they, you know, they had the numbers, so dad lost that one. And we traveled around looking for a martial arts school. And we found one that we liked. And what I did not know until much later was that they had called the sensei of this school, his name was Sensei Ralph Sumlin, at the Fairmont Karate Academy, and they had told him my entire story before I went there. So upon arriving, he already knew everything about me before I even walked in the place.
Right.
And he told him, I got this, don't worry.
Wow.
I must tell you this first experience so that everyone just knows what the first experience was like. Because this was the life changer. It was a complete life changer from there. Okay, moving with them was a life changer. But my sensei has such a huge part in my change, and it was started here. So the day I walked in, I was super cocky because I already have been a violent kid for so long. I'm like, man, I'm going to learn karate. I'll be a black belt in like 2 weeks, no problem. So, you know,
yeah, that
I had my bag. Oh, man, I thought I was a ninja. So before taking one lesson, so I have my bag, mm-hmm. and I walked up into the place. And before I walked in, I could hear them from the outside. Everyone's in there doing their training. Man, I pushed the door open, and I walked in, and I literally said, I'm here. Ha-ha. Where do I change? That's exactly what I said.
Wow. Did you really?
Oh, yeah. I was,
you actually said
that. I was
that.
Pretty cocky. Yes.
Wow.
So I walked in. Everyone got silent. Since the sensei, he looked at me. Who are you? I said, I'm James, man. Where do I change? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, James, we bow before you walk in here. So the mm-hmm. first thing you're going to do is go back out the door, down the steps, and out into the street, and start over.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first meeting with Sensei Ralph Sumlin. So I walked down the steps again, walked outside, and I looked up at the window. He was looking out the window to make sure I was actually in the street. So he told me, come on back in. So I was like, okay, I better listen. There's a lot of big dudes in here, so I'm outnumbered. I better listen to this guy.
Yeah.
So I walked up. Yeah, I walked in, and I bowed. And he said, good. Now, go in that room and change and come out onto the floor. Now, I'm sizing this guy up, right, because I size up everyone. That's always how I used to start confrontations with people. I would size them up to kind of gauge my chance of whooping them or not. And I'm
okay.
looking at this guy. He's about $150. He's old. He's probably 66. I'm like, man, uh-huh. I'm going to beat the sleeves off this guy. Right? So I go change, come out in my karate outfit. He tells me, get in the corner, learn how to do proper punches and kicks before you come out onto the floor. So I'm like, all right, man. So he sent someone over to teach me. I had no idea he was counting how many punches and kicks I was throwing because he was teaching the class. So he walked over to me, and he said, okay, you've done 100 of everything. Come out onto the floor. So I come out onto the floor. He tells everyone to sit down, grabs a pair of gloves, and throws them at me. And he says, I hear that you're a tough guy, and I hear that you like to beat people up. So why don't you beat me up? And I was like, okay. So I put on the gloves. And the last thing I said before the 3 minutes of hell was, are you sure? You sure you want to do this? You got dental insurance?
That's damn.
Oh, had no idea what a 50-degree black belt meant. Had no idea.
Wow.
The next 3 minutes were the worst 3 minutes of my entire life.
He
said, come on. Oh, dude, I hit the floor maybe 10 times, and I never touched him. I don't know how. I swear I threw punches. I swear I threw kicks. I don't know why I hit all air.
Oh.
And he actually didn't hit me either, but somehow he kept tripping me and I kept falling on my face.
Wow.
And he told me finally the floor. I was just crying. I couldn't even grab him. And
mm-hmm.
he finally walked over to me and he said, "Are you done?" And I was mm-hmm. like, "Yeah, man, I'm done." And he said, "Good. Now we can teach you something."
Mm.
And that was
wow.
it.
Yeah.
That was,
so
was the entire game changer.
Yeah, when you're talking about that, I mean, honestly, no exaggeration, I'm like getting chills as you're telling that story, James, because really it's so reminiscent of what life is for most of us, you know what I'm saying? Like this was
mm-hmm.
your journey, but so many times we have to be brought down to that place before we can get back up, you know? We think we're
mm-hmm.
all that, and then we have to be brought low before we can realize that, wow, now I'm in a place where I can learn something, you know? And, wow, that was your actual experience. So now you're going through this martial arts, and like you said, you just didn't take classes. You're winning stuff left and right. You're a champion. What was going on in your head? Like, okay, you know what I'm saying? You just didn't win. You just didn't go out there and play and get your belt. I mean, you were a champion. Tell us a little bit about the winning, the successes here.
So, you know, it was a great outlet for me because I was already kind of an angry kid. And, you know, I would say that it was all the training because I have some great trainers. Actually, in that gym, there were already champions. You know, there was Nikki Lee. She was a world champion. And then there were a couple national champions. Like, my sensei was a champion. He was in the Hall of Fame of martial arts. So there were already a bunch of champions already there that I was learning from. Little did I know, I didn't know who they were. I just know they kept whooping me all the time, and I couldn't figure out why. So, you know, the thing is that when I started, I just got into it. It's one of those things where when you want to be great, you just have to, become almost insanely saturated in what you do. And if, you know, I went to my first tournament after 1 month of lessons and I won first place every division I was in. And from there, somebody said to me, and I can't remember who said it, but they said, "I think you have a gift." Said no one wins in their first month of training. You literally had, I went, what, two times a week? So I literally had two, four, six lessons, and I won my first tournament. So somebody said, you know, you have a gift. You might want to pursue this. But it wasn't, that's not what pushed me. For one, I liked really big trophies. I don't know. I'm very materialistic when it came to that. I would see these trophies that were 6 feet tall, and I'm like, man, I want one of those. And I would say to my opponents, like, I got to whoop you to get one of those, so I guess I got to whoop you then. And that was kind of the way I felt about it. That was one thing. But
mm-hmm.
but actually, it was the family atmosphere that I never had. It was, you know, it was that my parents used the martial arts to keep me straight in school, to keep me straight at home. And then when I went down to the dojo, like, when we would go to tournaments, we'd all wear, like, a team shirt. And we would all meet. We'd all drive a couple of hours to get to the location. We'd all meet up as a group and walk in together as a team. Then we
right.
would win. We'd get in the paper all as a group. It was just this group atmosphere, you know,
right.
that I just didn't have. And
right.
and I still talk to these same people today. Like, I still, mm. you know, years, like, this group never left me. It was a group
right.
that I was never going to be abandoned by because they always stayed with me. Whenever I would fight, they were always cheering. Whenever, you know, whenever I was training, they were always there. And just, it was just that togetherness, that community feel that just kept
right.
me. It just sucked me in because I had never had it before. And the trophies just added the confidence that I could actually win something.
Yes, yes. So was your sense of family, like you said, like, with gang members, it's a sense of family. I mean, that's the
mm-hmm.
opposite, and you were doing something positive, but it's that same thing. You now belong.
Mm-hmm.
You now belong.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. If I may, let's just backstep a little bit. You and I offline talked a little bit about an article that I read. I believe it was from Mercury News. And thank you so much for sharing that, sharing your personal story. And that's always so important to me because we need real stories. You know what I'm saying? We don't need textbook stories. I love the real stories. But anyway, we talked about drugging our kids in the system, and it was really sad. It really sickened me because it was a story about how some of the shelters in California keep their kids sedated. You know, you talked about being angry, obviously, and you had reason to be angry. And I guess a lot of these places just turn their children over to the doctors and say, okay, medicate. Did you experience that at all? Was that part of your experience? Or what's your whole feeling around that? Let's go with it that way.
Big pharma. Yes.
Big pharma.
They are 100% the enemy. And yes, they tried to give me medication. I don't remember because I was quite young. I don't remember, I couldn't tell you exactly what the medications were because I don't really remember what they were. Sometimes they wouldn't even tell me what they were. They would just hand me like a little tiny cup with a pill in it and just tell me to take it.
Right.
And
right.
I never did. They always tried. I would put it in my mouth and then I would stick it like under my tongue or inside of my jaw. I would drink the water. Then I would leave and spit it out. And I can't tell you why. I just never liked the idea of eating something that made me feel weird where I couldn't defend myself. I was just always that scared of someone doing something to me that I just didn't like being vulnerable.
Yes.
And I saw other kids taking pills. I saw other kids taking pills and, you know, they had become like Jell-O. Like, you could just walk up and take something from them, and they couldn't do anything about it, or they would be acting really out of character. And I'm like, I don't want to be like that, because if I'm like that, somebody could walk and take my stuff. So I would never take the pills. But my feeling on it is that Big Pharma, they want this. You know, foster kids are a moneymaker for the medical industry. This is how I feel. This is my opinion.
Yes.
I agree with you. Yeah, because these kids, they get, you know, I'm currently in California. I live in San Diego. These kids out here, they get medical insurance until, if you're a foster kid, you can get medical insurance up to your, I believe 24, 20, something like that. You can get medical insurance through the state. And that medical insurance includes refillable medications. And if you think about it, kind of logical, so you think about this for a minute. If I am a very, very angry kid who has outbursts of anger like I used to have, and you give me a medication that will make me, you know, cool as a marshmallow, but for me to be that way, I have to keep taking that medication. And I have insurance that has refillable prescriptions. So that's years and years of taking this prescription. Now imagine me, I'm telling you to apply it to me. I went in at 10, okay? And so if they get me on this medication between 10 and 12, and I take it all the way till I'm 24, 26, what that does to the body is it was incredibly bad. But then, at this point, I'm addicted to this because I can't function without it. So now, I age out the medication as well. So what's going to happen then? You see, because no one ever solved the problem. You know, no one ever solved the problem. They just gave you a pill to suppress the situation.
Right. Mask it. Yes.
It's just a Band-Aid. It's the same thing as when you take a medication for a cold. So you take a medication for cold, doesn't solve the cold because there's no solving a cold. It's a virus. So, I mean, there is a way, but the medications you take, the Robitussins and all these other pills, they just suppress the symptoms.
Right.
They don't solve the situation. You know, an acidic stomach kills colds. The vitamin C, you know, when you become very acidic, it kills the virus. But they don't tell you that. No, they give you a medication that just suppresses the symptoms, right. Make you feel good for a couple of hours until you take some more.
Right.
And it's the same thing that's happening to these kids. Think about this. Think about the money machine here, okay? So you got currently you got 410,000 foster kids out there, right? All of them on some kind of medication that is refillable pharmacy insurance. So you can go take your card, refillable, and they're charging the state. They're charging the state for this because they're wards of the state. So this is 400,000 kids on a medication that they may have to stay on for 10 years or more. Think about that. You're making an entire salary off one kid. You got 400,000 of them. That's a lot of money that they want to keep flowing in.
Yeah. You know, James, it's just really overwhelming. I think somewhere in the future here I'm going to have to do a show just on Big Pharma and have you come back on, you know, because it really is when you say those numbers, like I had no idea how many children are out there, 410,000 all on some type of medication, and then think about all the other meds that they try to push on the kids in public school, right, when they don't sit still, you know, ADD, ADHD titles they put on them, labels they put on them. And then all the other medications that they're giving for people who have mental disabilities and all the opiates and all the other drugs that are being pushed in America right now. I mean, that's a whole subject all by itself. But it literally saddens my heart when you tell me this. Instead of helping these children heal, which is what you're doing now as you go around and you speak and speak to the parents, and the prospective parents of these children, and sharing with them how to really get to the bottom of the problem, which now I just want to have you talk a little bit about your book that you've written, because that is exactly what you're trying to do. Don't put a Band-Aid on this situation. Let's try to heal these children. Let's try to sincerely help them get to the root of the challenge. And you have a book, Your Amazing Itty-Bitty Foster and Adoptive Parent Guide, 15 Key Steps to Successfully Connect with Your Foster or Adopted Teen. And I want to just say to the audience, I love this. When James told me he was writing a book and it wasn't quite ready, so I thought, okay, no problem, we can talk about it. We can tell our audience about it, but it's not ready. And then James said to me, it was ready. You can read it. And I thought, there's no way I'm going to get through 300 pages before we go on the show. And I have to tell the audience, this guide that he has put together will work not just for foster parents or adoptive parents, but this book will help you as a parent, period. I said to James, I wish I had this document when I was raising my son 40-something years ago. I wish I'd had it. It's succinct. It's 40 pages long, actually 35 pages long, and he doesn't mess around. He just hits it. I think maybe that must have come from Mr. Griffith's training with you, James. Black and white.
Is.
Bam. There it is. Right?
It's true.
So,
yes.
You've got 15 steps here, and let's just look at a few of these steps for the audience, because talking about, you know, like you said, masking the problem and dealing with some of the issues that these young people come in with. And again, you can use this on your children today, listeners. You can use this if you're a manager. You can use these keys in your marriage. For instance, in his step number 3, you talk about no labels or hurtful statements. And I love what you say here. He said, labels hurt and are not necessary. There are also many statements that can be considered low blows and extremely sensitive to us. Each kid is different, but the list I have applies to most of us. Please don't say or do to us. Now, do you have your book in front of you? You want to
Yes, I'm looking at it.
About that? Okay. So talk to us about those steps, please, because this applies to life, period, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, well, you know, the first one is the biggest one. Don't call us foster kids. So people label, you know, all of us who have been through the system as foster kids, but that is a label. So the correct terminology really should be child or teen in foster care. And the reason is because fostering is a institution. We are a kid or a child who is in that institution, but that is, we were not born this way. So we are in a foster care situation because of something that happened, not because we were just suddenly born but with an immaculate conception and immediately ended up with someone. Something happened there. And so I am not a product of foster care. I'm just someone who was in it. So when you call someone a foster kid, it makes them feel isolated, different, uncomfortable, when most kids in foster care are trying to feel as normal as possible. And so that's a really bad thing to do, especially when a kid is in a home with a family. You know, don't call that kid a foster kid if you're taking care of them. They're a kid too. There's no foster at that point. Just don't call them that. It's bad.
They're just another kid integrated
right
into the family. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I wrote these things because a lot of these things happened to me. So when you're with a family and then they say, "Well, this is our son and this is our foster kid." Think how that makes that kid feel. That kid now feels isolated, different, not part of the family or anything because you just did that. Everyone, obviously, especially like me, I'm a kid who's, you know, I'm of mixed race and I'm with an all-white family. Obviously, there's something going on there. You don't need to make it blatantly clear in my face and loud.
Right.
Yeah, the first time that my dad called me his son was like a bigger deal to me than winning a tournament. Like the first time I heard him say it, you know, a friend came over and he said, I was the only one there at the time. His actual son was somewhere, maybe with his mom. I don't know where he was, but he said, "Yeah, this is my son, James." And he said it so nonchalantly and cool. You know, he kind of said it. He didn't realize how that impacted me when he said it. I just felt so happy and warm and awesome because of it.
Yes.
And that's how they've always been that way.
And that's why they made a huge difference. They turned your life around.
Let me see. So continuing on here, step two was most of us have parents. Some of us want to return to them. Some of us still visit them. Don't expect us to call you mom and dad. There's a chance our parents abuse us, so it hurts to say the words. We're not trying to offend you by not calling you that. I have some situations where I would move into a home and somebody would tell me, I'm mom and that's dad and that's what you're going to call us. And I'm thinking to myself, like, no, you're not. You know, and you can't force someone to call you that. That title means different things to different people. And
right.
I was never going to call anyone mom or dad who didn't treat me so. And Robin and Carolyn Griffith, I do call my mom and dad still today. I talk to them on a weekly basis. Those are my parents. And you can't tell me they're not. And they call me their son, so I call them mom and dad. But some kids are still trying to get back with their parents, or they miss their parents. And they don't want to call you mom and dad, but you can't get offended by that because you really aren't. So, you know, it's kind of a big deal.
So when they're ready, in other words, you're saying that's when it happens and not until then.
Right. And the thing is, you should never even expect it, because if you're not really their mom and dad, and especially if the mom and dad are still in the picture. Like if you have a kid whose parents maybe are having to go through, you know, AA, or they're having to go through some kind of abuse training before they can get their kid back, if the biological parents are still in the picture, then you can't expect that kid to call you mom and dad because the biological parents are still in the picture. So if they don't call you mom and dad, even if they got to stay with you for an extended period of time, you can't get mad about that.
Right, and all it is a label anyway. You're there in the home to supply support and love And that's really the important thing. I'm going to jump over to step number 13 due to time.
Okay.
And I wanted to spend just a little bit of time here. Your step 13 says, if we are you, we will say mean things, but we still need you. Talk to us about that a little bit, because that happens, again, in marriages. We say things, don't really mean it. We still love each other. Talk to us about it in the situation you were in.
Yeah, so you're going to, you know, you're going to run into conflict, especially, you know, you have different personalities clashing with different personalities. And so things aren't always going to go in sync. They didn't raise you from a baby, so they don't think like you do. And so you're going to run into an argument here and there. And when it happens, and this depends on, this is case by case. So this is not like a blanket thing that works with everyone. Some kids, it just works out perfect. Me, I was a hard head, knucklehead kid. So I would say some pretty ignorant things sometimes to people. And you just really have to see through it. A lot of times it's all posturing. A lot of it's posturing. You think we want to go back to a shelter? No, we don't. I would love to just stay right where I'm at. So most of the time, if we just don't want to do something or we don't get our way, we're going to say, you know, we're going to make some mean statements. You're not my mom and dad. I hate this place. Yada, yada, yada. We're going to say these things because we're not getting our way. But that isn't any different than any other kid would do. Even
Absolutely.
Your own kid does that. Yeah, so it's just the difference is that they look at you like if my biological kid says it, it's like, oh, that's my kid, so he's just being smart, out of around him or something. But when it's a foster kid, it's like, you know what, you don't have to be here anyway. You're not my kid anyway. And then that's the mindset you get. It's like, you're rebelling, and it's like, no, your kid does the same thing. Especially
exactly.
kids these days. Good gracious, the way
that's
kids talk
right.
to their parents these days.
No kidding. Absolutely correct. Well, you know, James, if you wanted to leave a golden nugget, if it's something that you want the listeners to remember, if nothing else, what is that takeaway that you would give them? And we're going to come back and tell the audience how to get your book, but I want to be sure that you leave a nugget with the listeners.
Interesting about that is you took my thunder at the very beginning of the show. The nugget that I always leave is that Henry Ford quote. It's my favorite quote of all time, that if you think you can, if you think you can't, you're right. That quote is a quote that I live by. I live by
yes.
it because I have learned.
I love that one.
I have learned.
Yes.
Yeah, I've learned about mindset, and I've mm-hmm. learned through all of this. One of the things you learn in martial arts is, you know, it really is mindset. You get in touch with your spiritual self very well, and it's a lot more than punching and kicking. There's a whole lot of
yes.
meditation and just learning about yourself. And so one of the nuggets I like to leave is that quote. And also, you know, ultimately it comes down to the person in the situation to make that decision. No matter
right.
how terrible things were going for you, you ultimately know what's right and wrong. You do. You
yes.
may need some guidance here and there, but you basically know what's right and wrong. And so if you want to set up, you know, a positive future for yourself, then you got to make those right decisions. And that comes down to the individual to make those decisions. And if you make the decisions that are going to help you, even if they don't help you immediately, if you're in a bad situation right now, but you might make a good decision that helps you later, always be looking to make that good decision that's gonna send you down the positive road later. Because when you're young, you know, you have lots of time, but you have lots of time to make good moves or bad moves. Make
yes.
those good moves. Make those moves that are going to set your future up. And no matter how hard it is, you can climb out of it. You can really, really climb out of it. You just have to decide that you're going to climb out of it and not decide that I'm going to give up. There's no giving up unless you choose to. So when you end up in a bad situation, it's because you chose to be there. Just don't make that choice.
Yes. Just don't make that choice. It is all about choices. James, quickly tell the audience where they can get your book, please. Where can they find it?
Okay, so you can go to my website, jameshpoindexter.com or inspiredtosuccess.com. That is my website that they both will take you to the same place. It's on Amazon. Nook, iTunes, Kobo. It's everywhere. And the paperback is coming. Right now it's a download, it's an ebook, but I have the paperback in my hand. I just approved it, so it's going to be up soon too. Get it from Amazon if you can, because that helps me get on the bestseller list, you know.
Yes.
And check out my website, man. Awesome. I would love to come and speak everywhere.
Yes. And I just want to say congratulations. It is a wonderful read. It's a succinct, concise read, Your Amazing Itty Bitty Foster and Adoptive Parent Guide, 15 Key Steps to Successfully Connect with Your Foster or Adoptive Teen. James, we are out of time. Gosh, it went so quickly. Thank you. I'd love to have you back again. Listeners, invite him out to speak. This man is so inspiring. So, again, to my audience, thank you for tuning in. We love you. Be blessed. Hear you next week. Bye-bye.